From Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Free Speech Radio News. It's Thursday, February 12, 2009. A new report indicates that half the weapons the U.S. and its allies send to Afghanistan go missing. As outrage grows over the Salmonella outbreak,
what I really find amazing is that it was known and yet released into the food stream anyway. How could that possibly happen?
Consumer advocates are calling to reform the FDA. And we continue our energy series and hear why some environmentalists are wary of wave power. I'm Aura Abogado. Those stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Pakistan acknowledged today that the coordinated terrorist attacks that killed 198 people in Mumbai were plotted partially on Pakistani soil. FSRN correspondent Mazrour Hussain reports from Islamabad.
Despite immense diplomatic pressures since the November attacks in Mumbai, Pakistan has maintained it did not have enough information from India to trace the terror suspects. But today, at a crowded press conference in Islamabad, the country's internal security advisor Rehman Malik said the Pakistani government has arrested six terror suspects, including Zaki Lakhvi, a military commander of the alleged terror organization Lashkar-e-Taiba.
Some part of the conspiracy has taken place in Pakistan, and all those, according to the available information, most of them, they are in our custody.
Malik said Pakistan has fulfilled its duty, taking all possible measures. But analysts in Pakistan attribute the breakthrough to United States Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke's current visit to the country. Meanwhile, Lashkar-e-Taiba has accused Islamabad of implicating its leaders in the Mumbai attacks to get a pat on its back from India and the United States. For FSRN, I'm Masroor Hussain in Islamabad.
Officials in the southern Australian state of Victoria say they believe the death toll from the massive wildfires could reach 300. Already 181 people are confirmed dead, nearly 1,000 homes have been destroyed, and a couple towns have been nearly wiped off the map. 35 fires continued to burn today. Authorities believe arson is the cause, but today police released two people arrested in connection with the fires. Police in the South Indian state of Tamil Nadu arrested nearly 100 protesters today. The arrests came after demonstrators converged on a military installation in protest of the continuing war in Sri Lanka. Bismillah Gilani reports.
Unrest is growing in the Tamil Nadu state as the war between the Sri Lankan army and the Tamil Tigers continue to put civilians at risk. Hundreds of lawyers and students today staged a demonstration in the central city of Tiruchirappalli to protest what they call the failure of central Indian government to broker a ceasefire in Sri Lanka. Most people in Tamil Nadu are Tamil Tigers sympathizers, and the state has seen frequent protests since the fighting in Sri Lanka intensified last month. Meanwhile, thousands of fishermen from Rameshwaram, the closest Indian city to Sri Lanka, have announced an indefinite strike. They allege the Sri Lankan Navy has been attacking fishermen in the area. For FSRN, this is Bismillah Gilani from New Delhi.
Protests against the war in Sri Lanka have been happening in other countries as well, including a U.S.-based hunger strike that has entered its second week, led by members of the D.C.-based organization People for Equality and Relief in Lanka. A special court convened as part of the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program ruled today that those who claim childhood vaccines cause autism are not entitled to federal compensation. The claimants were not required to give indisputable scientific evidence of the link, only to show a simple majority of evidence supported their claim that the measles, mumps, and rubella shots triggered autism in their children. But the judge ruled the evidence presented fell far short of demonstrating a link. The Tennessee Valley Authority is estimating it will cost as much as $825 million to clean up the massive coal ash spill that happened in Tennessee. In December, a retaining wall surrounding a pool of coal byproduct broke, spilling over 1 billion gallons of sludge into a populated valley and river inlet. The announcement came today from the TVA CEO, who added they have already spent $31 million on the cleanup project. The utility is in the process of buying out the families whose homes were destroyed. Environmental groups are claiming victory today after the Forest Service removed over 90% of the proposed national forest lands along Colorado's western slope from the auctioning block. Blake Wesley has the story from Denver.
Over 130,000 acres of public land were set to be auctioned to the oil and gas industry today, but only 12,000 acres were sold. The U.S. Forest Service withdrew the land after county officials and environmental groups claimed oil and gas drilling would destroy the local environment. They say there were no adequate reviews of potential natural resource damage. While environmentalists succeeded in scaling down the sale of leases, over 60 write-in protests were still filed. The Bureau of Land Management told FSRN protests have become, quote, standard at these kind of auctions. Late last year, one activist even disrupted the sale by bidding on the oil and gas leases himself. But the BLM said no protesters were obviously present at today's auction. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Blake Wesley.
And finally, not only does today mark the 200th birthday anniversary of two of the most influential people in history, Charles Darwin and Abraham Lincoln, it also marks the 100th anniversary of the NAACP. The National Association for the Advancement of Colored People was founded to respond in part to African-American disenfranchisement in the South. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
U.S. Envoy Richard Holbrooke met senior officials after arriving in Afghanistan today, following 4 days in neighboring Pakistan. Holbrooke is in the region on a fact-finding mission to revamp U.S. policy there. Meanwhile, back on Capitol Hill, a new report reveals that more than half of the weapons the U.S. and allies sent to Afghanistan to arm and train Afghan troops are unaccounted for. The auditors said it's likely that weapons are falling in the hands of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The U.S. government, with the help of other countries, has spent $220 million on small arms such as rifles, grenade launchers, and machine guns for Afghan security forces. But of the 375,000 weapons sent, the Defense Department has no records of or can't account for 60% of them. These findings came today in a report from the Government Accountability Office, or GAO, the independent federal body that conducts government oversight. Charles Michael Johnson co-authored the report. He says SISTICA, the body in charge of training and arming Afghan soldiers, fails to track the weapons from their first minutes in Afghanistan.
The equipment is flown into Kabul, and what we discovered, and the team that went there, what we discovered was that once it gets in Kabul, there is no shipping manifest for SISTICA to actually do inventory to make certain that it received what it should have received.
The Department of Defense generally uses serial numbers to keep track of weapons sold overseas. But in Afghanistan, the Defense Department was unable to supply serial numbers or could not match the serial number with the location of the weapons. Representative Steve Dryhouse of Ohio asked Johnson where the lost weapons end up.
You know, are these weapons falling into the hands of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda? Do we have any evidence that, in fact, these weapons are getting into the hands of hostile forces?
Some of those reports have had some allegations of reported theft of weapons and potentially weapons being sold to enemies.
Violence in Afghanistan is on the rise. An attack on government offices yesterday killed 24 people, including 8 attackers. General David Petraeus said recently that the security situation in Afghanistan has deteriorated in the past 2 years. Some members of Congress, including Republican John Duncan of Tennessee, are concerned that Afghanistan is going to become another military black hole for the United States.
I hate to say it because I'm not a pacifist and I consider myself to be very pro-military, but the Defense Department has turned into the Department of Foreign Aid and has become the most wasteful department probably in the entire federal government.
A report in 2007 gave a similar picture of weapons in Iraq. The GAO reported that 190,000 U.S.-supplied pistols and AK-47s for Iraqi security forces were missing. The GAO says the weapons tracking in Iraq has improved, but the challenges in Afghanistan are much greater. That's because of a non-existent legal system and lack of necessary cooperation by the Afghan government, they say. The GAO recommends that the Defense Department set up a weapons registration and monitoring program and increase personnel to train Afghan forces. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
And in addition to Afghanistan, the U.S. government made weapons sales agreements totaling $32 billion in 2007 alone. That's triple the amount from Bush's first 4 years in office. Some of the largest recipients of U.S. weapons are countries involved in internal conflicts or acts of aggression against their neighbors. Frida Berrigan is a senior program associate at the New America Foundation's Arms and Security Initiative. She outlines some of the volatile nations the U.S. has recently sold arms to.
Pakistan in 2006 and 2007, Pakistan was the largest recipient of U.S. weapons. And of course, Pakistan and India have fought three wars against one another over the course of the last 60 years. And Pakistan is an increasingly unstable nation and also has a history of abusing the human rights of its own population. Israel was another major recipient of U.S. weapons with $2.2 billion in transfers. Colombia was also a major recipient with $580 million worth of weapons sold during those 2 years, 2006-2007. So there's often this argument made by the Pentagon saying we sell weapons for security and for peace and stability, and that's what our weapons do throughout the world. But when we look at who actually receives these weapons and how they're being used, clearly that's not the case.
And how do you see this changing with the new administration, or do you see it changing? Do you see a change in terms of how many arms the U.S. is selling and where they're being sold?
You know, that's it's a really good question, and it's an open question. Throughout the course of the Bush administration, we saw an increase in the dollar value of weapons sold, an increase in the number of countries that were eligible to receive U.S. weapons. And most of that had to do with sanctions being lifted against certain countries that would become our close allies in the global war on terror. And the United States essentially trading cooperation in the global war on terror or assistance for weapons. In the case of Pakistan, we needed access to Pakistani territory and Pakistani intelligence in order to wage the war in Afghanistan. And Pakistan was under international sanctions because it developed nuclear weapons and because President Musharraf was not democratically elected, came to power in a coup. So those sanctions were lifted weeks after September 11th, 2001, in order to facilitate cooperation between Pakistan and the United States. So will the Obama administration continue this trend of basically a weapons for all trend, or will he try and roll back some of this? We don't really know. He made very few statements about the arms trade, specifically throughout his campaign. And in fact, in a few instances when he was asked directly about it because of big deals that were in the newspaper, specifically in the case of weapon sales to Taiwan and weapon sales to Israel and Middle Eastern states, in each one of those instances, he indicated, support for those sales. Joe Biden, the vice president, now has a much longer track record in the Senate and has been outspoken against some specific weapon sales. And we don't know the extent to which that perspective will be, brought to bear. But in the past, Joe Biden has said, why are we selling, high-tech fighter planes to Pakistan? These are F-16 fighter planes manufactured by Lockheed Martin. They're nuclear weapons delivery vehicles. Why are we selling these to Pakistan? And has raised those questions in the past. So will those questions come from the White House? Remains to be seen.
Frida Berrigan is a senior program associate at the New America Foundation's Arms and Security Initiative. Human rights groups released hundreds of pages of documents today, which they say confirms the Department of Defense was involved in secret prisons located overseas. FSRN's Karen Miller reports.
Some 950 documents were released, although most of them were reprints of newspaper articles, according to the Center for Constitutional Rights, one of the plaintiffs in a Freedom of Information lawsuit against the U.S. government. But plaintiffs say the documents were a first step. Director of the Center for Human Rights and Global Justice, Meg Satterthwaite.
We want information about who knew what, when about the program, who authorized what and when, and we also want to know who was disappeared in this program. It is the right of the individual to know what happened to them, and it is also the right of the American public to know what was done in their name.
The documents, plaintiffs say, confirm the existence of so-called ghost prisons in Iraq and Afghanistan. They say it also shows the DOD worked with the CIA on the secret detention program. One document, dated May 2004, is titled Applicability of Geneva Conventions to Ghost Detainees. Another document, dated February 2006, is an email exchange between an unnamed U.S. political advisor and General Norton Schwartz about delaying the release of detainees to avoid bad press. Attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, Gitanjali Gutierrez.
The emails are making the recommendation that return flights of men who are detained in Guantanamo be delayed for 45 days or so until, quote, things die down. Otherwise, we are likely to have heroes' welcomes awaiting the detainees when they arrive. Another email in this set also recommends that a more discreet plane be used to deliver the men when they arrive home to attract less press attention.
Of the more than thousands of pages released, plaintiffs say most of what would be of interest was redacted. Fellow at the Center for Human Rights and Global Justice at New York University, Amna Akbar.
In the litigation, the CIA has extensively cited as a rationale to redact information that they don't want to release any information about the operation of the program because that will communicate to potential terrorists or terrorists the way that the program operates and therefore harm national security and the effectiveness of the program. So our thought is that if the program is not running anymore, then what's the harm in releasing that information to national security? So we're pushing the government on that now.
The government is supposed to respond to Freedom of Information requests within 20 days, but to just get these documents, it took 5 years, and the government is asking for even more time. Many had hoped that Obama would provide a change from the practice, but plaintiffs say a recent case puts that into question. Attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, Gitanjali Gutierrez.
We are already seeing in the Obama administration a hesitancy to come out strongly against practices like rendition to torture and to come out strongly to never, ever use these practices again. And prosecutions of high-level officials who have engaged in criminal conduct is really the only way to prevent that from happening again.
For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Karen Miller.
Outrage over the Salmonella outbreak continues to grow as newly released emails suggest that executives at Peanut Corporation of America knowingly released contaminated peanut products. While federal authorities are investigating the company for the outbreak linked to hundreds of illnesses and 9 deaths, Congress members and consumer advocates have called for Food and Drug Administration reform. Africa Jones reports.
At Wednesday's House hearing, Illinois Congressmember Jane Schakowsky had one important question.
What I really find amazing is that it was known by the Peanut Corporation of America that their product was tainted with potentially life-threatening salmonella and yet released into the food stream anyway. How could that possibly happen?
While there are ongoing criminal investigations into Peanut Corporation's actions, critics say that this latest salmonella outbreak is another sign that the federal agency charged with ensuring the food supply is broken.
It just shows the deficiencies of the Food and Drug Administration's food safety inspection program.
Tony Corbo is the legislative representative for Food and Water Watch, a nonprofit consumer organization.
The FDA said the last time they were in that plant prior to this foodborne outbreak was in November of 2001. They wound up taking action as a result of people dying and getting sick. That winds up being too late for them to have done the proper thing.
For years, consumer advocates have said FDA needs more inspectors and broader regulatory authority. Some have even called for the entire agency to be restructured. William Hubbard, former associate commissioner at the FDA, testified at a Senate hearing last week.
When I came to FDA in the 1970s, there were 70,000 food firms. FDA inspected 35,000 times a year. So they got to everybody every couple of years, generally. Today, there are 150,000 registered firms with FDA, and FDA does 7,000 food inspections. That basically means there's no there there. And you can correlate, Mr. Chairman, as FDA inspectors stopped going in the 70s and 80s and 90s, recalls went up.
Our organization is in litigation with the FDA right now because they will not tell us how many inspectors they have.
Tony Corbo.
They will not tell us how many inspectors are out there employed by the FDA trying to protect American consumers. This is outrageous. We've heard that it may be as low as 200 inspectors.
FDA does some inspection through state government subcontractors, but in the Peanut Corporation case, FDA officials say that Georgia inspectors did not do testing for salmonella in 2007 or 2008, even though the company had positive test results in its records. The law doesn't require companies to inform regulators of positive test results, nor do the FDA or state regulators have instant access to the information. In addition to budgetary constraints, the FDA has no mandatory recall authority. So even though FDA found salmonella contamination and unsanitary conditions at Peanut Corporation's plants, the current recall is still on a voluntary basis by the company. White House spokesperson Robert Gibbs says changes at the FDA are coming.
I think the revelations have no doubt been alarming. The president, like I said, in the coming days will have a new commissioner at FDA and to put in place a stricter regulatory structure to ensure that the type of thing that happened in this case doesn't happen again.
The Food and Drug Administration Globalization Act introduced in the House this year would allocate more resources for inspection, require more stringent safety plans by companies, and give the FDA mandatory recall authority. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Africa Jones.
The Obama administration is stalling the Bush administration's last-ditch effort to drill for oil in the Outer Continental Shelf. Secretary of Interior Ken Salazar is extending the public comment period on Bush's five-year oil and gas drilling proposal from 60 days to 6 months. In the meantime, Salazar is ordering his department to research the possibility of renewable energy developments off the nation's coasts, like wind, tidal, and wave power. As part of FSRN's energy series, Running on Empty, today we look at wave power, which uses the ocean currents to generate electricity. The new source of power is touted as the next green or blue technology, but as FSRN's Christina Anastad reports, wave power could impact marine life, and some environmentalists are calling for conservation instead.
Northern California has one of four rare upwellings in the world. That's where ocean currents push nutrient-rich food from the ocean floor to the water surface. The upwelling supplies nearly the entire state's coastline with food. Environmentalists say the push for wave energy in California could disrupt that cycle. Judith Vitiver is with the Ocean Protection Coalition.
It will reduce wave action, and to reduce that by putting these giant machines in there could be devastating for the marine environment. We do need to generate renewable sources of energy. However, we don't need to be getting that energy out of the ocean. It needs to be protected. It's impacted by increases in temperature. The acidity level is rising. There are dead zones that are spreading all over the world. It's been overfished.
Vitiver says solar and wind power are tried and true renewable sources, whereas wave power remains an unknown. But some environmental groups are putting their stamp on the blue technology. In November, a consortium of wave energy developers, power companies, and environmental groups sent a policy paper to the Obama transition team urging support for wave energy. Catherine Burnham is with the Environmental Defense Fund.
We're hoping that it could actually be a positive, a win-win
for consumers and a win-win for the environment in the sense that global warming is a threat. It's really fueling the push for energy conservation and the development of green, low-carbon energy. And now we might actually have a movement towards environmentally responsible blue energy from the sea.
How green or blue is wave power? The National Marine Fisheries Service states wave energy could disrupt 2 endangered and 6 threatened fish on the West Coast and disrupt the migrations of marine mammals, including endangered gray whales. Determining what marine areas should be off limits to wave energy plants is up to the 7-member Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Ann Miles is with FERC.
It's done on a case-by-case basis.
Does FERC have any guidelines or criteria for establishing a sensitive area?
We did not do that. Purposely, we did not define it. We wanted to see what people think.
Are you going to have that?
No, we're not. We're not planning to. What we're going to do it is on a case-by-case basis.
Last year, FERC gave the green light for a wave energy project located in a national marine sanctuary in Washington, a move that spurred a lawsuit from the state. Now the company, Finnevera Renewables, is pulling the plug, stating the project's no longer economically feasible, given the nation's economic crisis. Another wave array proposal would be located within the waters of the Gulf of the Farallones National Marine Sanctuary near San Francisco. Mindy Spatt is with TURN, the Utility Reform Network, a utility watchdog. She says conservation should be on the table before new power plants.
We don't want to build plants that we don't really need. Of course, renewables are much better for the planet than fossil fuels, but they're not necessarily much better for the pocketbook, and rather we would like to see folks using less and having lower bills. We believe that there's much more that California can do to use the energy we're using now much more efficiently.
Supporters say wave power could provide up to 10% of the nation's energy consumption. A new report from the Rocky Mountain Institute estimates the nation could reduce its energy consumption by 30% if it just conserved. That could supersede the need for wave power and its potential impacts. I'm Christina Onnestad reporting from the studios of KZYX and Z for Free Speech Radio News.
To mark Black History Month, here's Mumia Abu-Jamal with a profile in excellence.
In celebration of African Heritage Month, for profiles in excellence, we honor Chinua Achebe, Nigerian novelist, whose 1960 classic Things Fall Apart inspired Black readers and writers around the world with his three-dimensional portrayal of colonized people and tribal life. Achebe once said his work was done to show that African societies were not mindless, quote, but frequently had a philosophy of great depth and value and beauty, unquote. His works abolished the notion that colonialism was a force for good in the world. His books include No Longer at Ease, Arrow of God, A Man of the People, and Ant Hills of the Savannah. Achebe was born November 16, 1930, in Ogidi, Nigeria. For Hard Knock Radio and Prison Radio, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And that will do it for today's newscast. You've been listening to FSRN, which is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. You can send us your feedback by emailing us at comments@fsrn.org. That's comments@fsrn.org. Our newscast is produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Our Washington, D.C. editor is Leanne Caldwell, and our headlines editors are Nell Abram and Jess Burns. Our tech team at KPFA in Berkeley today includes Puck Lowe and Rose Katabchi. From Pacifica Station, KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.